Just think about investing $20,000 right now. Let's say your first car you buy at 22 out of college. It's 20 grand. If you were to take 20 grand at age 22, put it in the market, say a stock and bond portfolio, say even 80-20 or whatever, index fund kind of thing, and you left it there for 50 years, that grows into a pile of cash, right? Just compounding. You're talking, I could do the math while we're on the show here.
I did it while you were talking. It's about $1 million.
Right, and that's just your first car.
I would like to welcome to the Student Loan Planner podcast today, Rob Berger. Rob is got an amazing story. He practiced law in DC for a while, had a little student debt from law school, ran one of the largest websites out there, Dough Roller, before he sold that. He works with Forbes now as a deputy editor, and most importantly, he's got a new book and website, retirebeforemomanddad.com. So I wanted to have Rob on the show because retiring before mom and dad sounds pretty freaking cool. Rob, welcome to the show.
Hey, Travis. How you doing?
Good. Tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself. I kind of gave them the Cliff Notes version, but tell folks a little bit about your story and who you are.
Sure. So I'm 50-something. I'm 52. And my wife and I live in Northern Virginia. I graduated law school in 92 with a truckload of student loans, by the way. I'm sure we'll talk about that. Started down the normal career path of practicing law in DC. A lot of debt, very expensive to live here, made a decent salary. And just to kind of shorten it all, made partner at the firm I was at and then realized it wasn't what I wanted. You know, you think that's what you want and you go for it and you spend a lot of time getting there. Then you get there and you're like, yeah, this isn't really quite what I thought it'd be. So that kind of led to a lot of different things and different jobs, legal jobs, but then ultimately starting Dough Roller, which was just a hobby at the time. And that turned into a business. Happy to go into as much detail as you want. But that kind of, I was sort of an accidental business owner, I suppose, after a couple of years of running the blog. And that then allowed me to retire from law along with a high savings rate. And fast forward to 2018, I sold, well, I retired from law in 2016, sold the blog in 2018 and sort of retired again. And then Forbes called me like, literally like 2 days later. And I was like, yeah, I don't think I want to get a job, but it kind of worked out. And so I've been doing some work for Forbes for the last year and a half or so. Then I ended up on the Student Loan Planner podcast. So there you go. That's my life story.
I know Dough Roller. It's a pretty big name in the personal finance blog space, but probably some of the listeners who don't obsessively look at personal finance blogs don't really know a ton about it. So maybe you could tell the listeners a little bit more about that so they can kind of get a sense for how legit that effort was.
It started out as just a hobby. It was 2007, practicing law. And I was kind of a little bored with it, and I was really focused on our finances. And so I just decided to start a blog as just a hobby. Didn't know a thing about it and started publishing content about investing, getting out of debt, student loans, right? You fast forward about a year and it started to make a little bit of money. And I'm thinking, well, you know, this could be more than a hobby. And I just kept learning how to build websites, learning how to get traffic to your site, learning how they make money. I met other bloggers, started going to conferences, and it just continued to grow. And then if you fast forward to 2018, I mean, I had probably 8 to 10 folks helping me on the site. In different capacities. Some were writers, some were editors, some were managing the advertising. So it really kind of grew into a full-time business. Again, it wasn't the plan, but it introduced me to folks from Vanguard on the blog and the podcast, folks from T. Rowe Price, Fidelity. So I've met a lot of people in the industry because of the blog. Started writing for Forbes. I wrote for US News and MSN Money and Yahoo Finance. And so one opportunity leads to another, and it kind of like a 10-year overnight success, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, it kind of turned into something much bigger than I would have ever imagined.
Do you ever get people that say, oh, this guy is a hypocrite because he's not retired before mom and dad because he just loves working so much and producing all this great content?
The thing about Retire Before Mom and Dad, the book, is that it's really not pushing the FIRE movement. I'm not pushing anyone to retire at a certain age. What I am pushing is achieving financial independence at a young age or relatively young age. What someone's going to do with it is up to them, right? I'm not here to tell anyone how they should enjoy their freedom once they have it. In my case, you know, I like working. Keep in mind that my Forbes job, I work from home. I work on my own schedule. I got no one looking over my shoulder. It's a lifestyle job in a way, and it's not going to be forever. I've told them I'm going to be retiring from Forbes. I haven't decided when yet. But when I do, it'll be to go do something else, probably my own thing. But that's just what I enjoy doing. Other people might want to golf every year. I've got a good friend who retired from the Air Force. He was a meteorologist. He golfs 5 or 6 times a week. That's just what he loves doing. people have a different view of what quote unquote retirement looks like or financial freedom. For me, it's still producing content to help folks with their money. That's just what I enjoy doing.
So our audience is primarily people that have six figures of student loan debt, although some people have five figures of student loan debt. Some people are just married to or care about people in their family, or maybe their financial advisors or somebody that they know in their life is affected by very large levels of student loan debt. So
yeah,
in terms of financial independence, a lot of times when you're staring down the barrel of a very negative net worth, financial independence seems like the farthest thing off in the world. And we have some very unique ways of talking about financial independence for people that need to go for loan forgiveness and people who owe five times their income in debt, which are very technical. But I want to pretend that that problems don't exist yet. And so just pretend for like your average person on the street, how would you define financial independence and how would you explain the FIRE movement to somebody that hasn't been reading a ton of the various blogs that exist on the space?
So the way I define financial independence in the book is to kind of give seven levels. The real key is that everything is tied to your expenses. It's true whether you make $50,000 a year or $500,000 a year or $5 million a year. It's tied to how your annual expenses. And that's an important concept because most people, I think, or a lot of people think of financial freedom or independence as a six-figure salary. And that certainly can, if you use it the right way, can get you there, but it's really about how much you spend. So to me, ultimate financial independence is 25 times your annual spending, which is just the, I'm sure, very familiar 4% rule that folks use. But what I do is I break it down because if you're just starting out, like you said, you've got debt or whatever, who can think that far ahead? I kind of think of it in steps. And to me, the first step is having 1 month worth of expenses. So the thing to keep in mind about that, Travis, is that you can have 100 grand in student loan debts and have a negative net worth, but still have the first level of financial freedom because you've got 1 month worth of expenses saved. And I view that as a very significant milestone because you're a long way off from any notion of retirement. You could handle an emergency. You could handle even a loss of a job, granted only for a month, but we're just getting started, right? It's that first moment when you're not living paycheck to paycheck. And I work from there. Then I go to 3 months, 6 months, a year. It kind of builds on itself as you build your way up to 25 times your annual expenses. But it's always geared towards how much you have saved compared to your annual expenses. And that's how I look at it.
You say 25 times your expenses. So everybody talks about this 4% rule because this is based off of a lot of studies that have been done saying that balanced portfolio of mutual funds and stocks and bonds can handle you pulling out 4% of your money every year for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So when you're financially independent with that traditional definition, sometimes people talk about being worried, what if the numbers are wrong? Because the future returns for stocks and bonds are going to be a lot worse because when those studies were written, bond yields were in the 5, 6, 7% range. You have stocks that were maybe yielding a lot more, were a lot more undervalued than they are today. So people will talk about the 3% rule being the new normal. Maybe you can talk to that for the nervous Nellies out there in the world.
Well, my response is you should be nervous. Maybe not the response people want to hear. You have to look at it, first of all, how old are you when you retire? And are you literally going to retire and never do another thing? Is that your plan? You're going to retire in a traditional sense at whatever, 35 or 40, and you don't plan to ever earn another dime. If that's you, then yeah, you should be very worried because the model really wasn't built to handle potentially 60 years of retirement. Now, it can still work out. A lot of it would depend on what they call sequence of return risks, what your returns are, say, the first 10 or maybe 15 or 20 years of your retirement. Do you end up going into a bear market or a bull market? So if that's your plan, then yeah, you really probably ought to think twice about it. I think as a planning tool, I think it's a perfectly a fine goal to aim for. But also keep in mind that, you know, you could have two people that say they're going to use the 4% rule. They've got their budget all set up and they can spend, they're right at the 4%, but they could be totally different because one could be, well, my necessities are 2% or 2.5%. And the rest of it is for like discretionary spending where they could cut back if they needed to. And another person could be, no, I've cut to the bone and I'm at 4%. If anything goes wrong, I'm going to have trouble keeping the lights on. Well, they're both using the 4% rule, but they're using it very differently. And I think the other thing to think about is if you do quit your job, depending on where you live and what your skill set is, how easy is it for you to get another job down the road if you needed to, that you would enjoy doing? You may prefer not to work, but if you had to, you'd enjoy doing it, it can make good money. I think for some people that would be easy, you know, whatever, you're a software engineer and it wouldn't be that difficult to get another job down the road if you wanted to. For other folks, it may be much more difficult. So I think the 4% rule is a good guideline and it's a good way to sort of think about it from a planning perspective. But once you actually get to the point of, okay, I'm ready to quit my regular job, that's when you really need to think through all of these issues and not simply rely on any sort of rule of thumb.
So the difference with most people pursuing financial independence and student loan borrowers is primarily student loan borrowers that want to pay off their debt. The math is the same as everybody else. You just have to pay off your debt and then work your way towards the assets that you need. The people who are, you know, your veterinarians who owe $400,000 and make $80,000
a year, yeah.
Basically the math becomes, the student debt becomes a tax based on income-based repayment. So you just lose 10% of your income. And then on top of that, you need somewhere in the neighborhood of $200,000 to $300,000 in assets to cover your future tax liabilities when the student loans are forgiven.
Right.
So the math is the same for student loan borrowers, even those going for forgiveness, except that you need probably an extra couple hundred thousand to cover your future tax liabilities. So I have actually advocated that people, financial independence, it's great if you have 25 times your expenses, but the concern that I have is that people would not make any life changes until that happens. And that's, I would argue, be a very bad thing. So I've actually advocated for people to start making significant life changes when you even simply have 2 times your annual expenses stashed away in assets because of the idea that if you have some semblance of stability and significant assets stashed away, that you'll be able to start a business or take that trip you've always wanted or maybe take a sabbatical from your job. I mean, what are those kind of conversations like when you're talking to somebody that wants to have a big life change, is in a job that they don't love, but they don't have a ton of assets yet? What do you tell them?
First of all, I couldn't agree more with what you just said. That's part of the problem with sort of traditional thoughts around retirement is you're doing all of this quote unquote sacrificing for something that's going to happen 50 years down the road. And until then, it's not going to affect you. But if you think about it from a financial freedom perspective, as you said, for example, 2 times your expenses, once you start moving down that path and you're not at 25 times, but you're at 2 or 5 times, it gives you the freedom to make choices you might not otherwise make. In my case, I made 2 career changes in my legal career, both of which, well, one involved a huge pay cut and the other one involved a moderate size pay cut. Some people are climbing the corporate ladder. I was climbing down the corporate ladder, but I was able to do that because of, I don't know where we were along that continuum, maybe 5 times our expenses or 7 times, something like that. I couldn't retire, but it gave me tremendous freedom to make career choices based on things other than the money. And so that's the nice thing about it is it can have a big impact on your life long before you get to 25 times your expenses or whatever other sort of rule of thumb you want to use. So I absolutely agree completely with what you just said.
We have a lot of people that are trying to work towards financial independence, but the problem is they need to cut their spending. And budgeting is something that doesn't work for most people. Most people do it for a few months and then they stop doing it. What we try to tell people to do is limit your house purchase to 2 times your joint income and then drive paid off cars. Then everything else will mostly figure itself out. But I'm interested in your view on what you call the money audit. So maybe you can tell listeners what the money audit is and how you could use it to potentially cut your spending.
So in the book, I kind of talk about 2 different approaches to reducing your spending. One of them is the money audit. And the idea there is make a list of all of your monthly bills, not your discretionary spending, not like groceries, but your actual bills. So everything from your rent, mortgage, all your debt payments, utilities, subscriptions, insurance, everything. And you really just go through and do a couple of things. First, you ask, do I really need all of this? Is there anything in here I can just get rid of? You know, the gym membership you haven't used in 6 months. I just got rid of our Hulu subscription, which only saved us $5.99 a month. Not a lot of money, but we never watched it. So why keep it? So go through that whole list. Can I get rid of anything? Of course, most is still going to be there. So the second step would be, do I need exactly what I've got? Can I make changes to what I have? Can I change my cable package? Can I increase the deductible on my car insurance? What changes can I make to all of these that would reduce the cost for debt? Of course, one big change would be refinancing the debt. Obviously, a big issue in the student loan area, particularly with federal loans, a lot of issues to think about there. But can you refinance any debt to bring down the interest rate? And then once you get past that step, then you say, okay, here's what I'm left with. Am I getting it at the cheapest way possible? Can I shop around for better life insurance or cheaper life insurance or cheaper car insurance or cell phone? I mean, a lot of people that I talk to save a bundle making changes to their cell phone plans. So when you go through these steps, the thing I like about it is you're not changing your lifestyle here, right? This isn't changing how many times you go out to eat every week or what vacation you take. So it's zero impact on your lifestyle. And most of the changes, you only have to do it once and then you save indefinitely. Save money on, say, your car insurance, for example. You make the change and you keep saving. And then the one thing I really stress, though, is once you go through this money audit and you've saved whatever you've saved, you've got to take that savings and automate it into your finances. So that could mean, depending on your debts, increasing the automatic payments to some debts that you may have. Again, student loans, you may not do that, depending on what kind of repayment plan you have. But you can increase the automated debt payments. Or if you want to save some or all of it, just, you know, you increase your 401k contribution or your automatic contribution to an IRA or a taxable account, whatever it might be. That's critical. But that's it. I mean, it's really pretty simple and straightforward. And I think it's an easy way to reduce your monthly expenses.
So let's give some specific numbers here. So I thought this would be kind of interesting. So in terms of lowering your student loan payment as low of a number as possible, if you are not killing it and making a ton of money, then probably the lowest payment you're going to get is by doing revised pay as you earn or pay as you earn and filing your taxes the right way if you're married. But if you are doing pretty well or you have private loans, I thought this would be a really interesting example, Rob. So I just ran a $100,000 loan, and that $100,000 loan could be refinanced, let's say, at 4.6% for a 20-year term. So that's a super low interest rate, but it's one that I actually have somebody that told me that they got offered recently because of how low rates are right now within the economy. So that payment would be about $638 a month for a 20-year term with a 4.6% interest rate. So a lot of people don't know this, but you can actually get your loan on a 30-year term with the government by consolidating. So if you say a 7% interest rate, then the payment would for 30 years actually be $665, which I think is really interesting because it shows what you're talking about. Like, you could be paying your loan back with a 30-year plan with the government at a higher interest rate and literally be paying more money and having the loan be scheduled to last for 30 years, or you could refinance it to a lower rate and be paying literally less and have that loan be scheduled to last for 20 years. So that's kind of an interesting example from the student loan piece. I want to ask you, like, for a specific example about the phone bill, because that's certainly something that I feel the pain for. What are some of your best hacks for reducing someone's phone bill?
So, and I confess, this is one that I've failed at miserably. So what I have found works for a lot of people is going off of like a Verizon plan, for example, and getting a Republic Wireless plan or a Cricket plan are two examples. Now, the downside for some people in doing this is you won't have the same selection of phones. I mean, they have great phones, but they may not have what you want. So you've got to look around. But the amount of money that folks are saving, you know, well over $100 a month, depending on family size and their existing plan. And at the end of the day, it's a phone. And when you take that money, say if you're going to save and invest it and just earn an average return over a number of years, it's going to grow into just a truckload of money. And that's just one thing. You know, we haven't gotten into reducing insurance, refinancing car loans. There's so many different ways you can go about it that reduce your spending. The phone, again, I think is sort of low-hanging fruit for a lot of people. Yeah, those are probably the biggest ones, is going to one of those type of programs, moving away from sort of the mainstream cell phone providers and going to something like a Republic Wireless is where I think most people are seeing the big savings.
One way to think about that is from a business perspective. So I'll just give you an example. So one of the things I'm thinking about right now is maybe even switching to a more expensive thing like Verizon Wireless. I'm on Google Fi right now. Usually it works pretty well, but there are areas where the coverage is not as good. And so if you have a business that depends upon being able to communicate with people clearly and having good audio quality and things like that, then in my mind, it almost makes sense for me to pay a lot of money for the best phone service, right? And so that's something that I'm exploring right now, is what is the best phone service where money is no object for what I want to spend on it, versus somebody who does not have a livelihood that depends upon the quality of their cell phone signal. That person that's paying up for this really expensive Verizon plan might be just wasting a whole bunch of money having a sort of a Ferrari in their pocket. And I'm not saying that Verizon's Ferrari, by the way. I hope nobody gets mad about that. But you don't need to pay for the luxury item or like the luxury category for something that you don't necessarily use that level of service, right? So thoughts on that?
Well, the difference is for you, this expense is needed to drive your business, to drive revenue. For an individual that just needs a phone to communicate, it's not driving revenue. It's pure expense. It's going to vary depending on your location and cell phone coverage. You know, in Northern Virginia, we're right outside of Washington, D.C. You think the cell phone coverage would be phenomenal, but it's not, oddly enough. So even Verizon can have issues. But for most of us, it's just an expense. It's not driving revenue to a business. So if you've got a business that depends on cell phone coverage and that sort of thing, yeah, you're probably going to want the best you can get. If it's just an expense, then maybe you don't need the best.
That makes sense. Now, you said something about refinancing a car loan.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that. Maybe you can share how you would even do that.
It's no different than really refinancing any loan. We actually, at one point, refinanced it onto a 0% credit card for a while and then just worked hard to pay it off. But you can refinance a loan online, you know, a car loan, really any type of loan. And you could even use something like LendingTree. Oddly enough, we'll do it, believe it or not. You could use a peer-to-peer lender, but I think it's unlikely you'd beat the rate that you have unless you've got a really high rate, maybe because of your credit score. You know, sometimes you can't beat the rate, particularly if you buy a new car. You may get a deal from the dealership and the car manufacturer that you just can't beat. But particularly if you've improved your finances and your credit score has come down, if you had a sort of a high rate to begin with, you can refinance it like any other debt. Of course, the best thing to do is get rid of your car, which I know a lot of people can't do, or go from two cars to one, or keep your car as long as possible. We just went from two cars down to one, and my wife is not convinced that I'll last because the one car we have is, I agreed that it's hers first. I only get to use it if she doesn't need it. So we'll see how long I can last without a car. But it's been 3 months, and so far I haven't died. So I got that going for me.
Well, I mean, there's this beautiful invention called Uber and Lyft, right?
Right.
I mean, so.
And a bicycle, too.
Well, yeah. I mean, my bike keeps getting stolen, but I'm bitter.
That's not good.
Well, I just, again, it's not investing intelligently in, like, you know, the right lock and stuff like that. But, you know, I think for the car, I think that's great advice. Every single person has two cars.
Well, here's the thing. Over a lifetime, you graduate from college, you're in your early 20s, between then and say when you're 70, when maybe, you know, you don't have a car by then, or I don't know. But if you think about it from a lifetime perspective, buying an average costing car every 5 years or every 10 years, or even every 15 years, the lost opportunity cost, if you were to invest that money instead, you're talking millions of dollars, roughly $3 to $5 million. And most people listening to this might not believe that number. That can't be right. I'm talking about buying, say, a $20,000 car every 5 years or every 10 years. But when you do the math, investing that money instead of buying the car, it does. It turns into millions of dollars, even with an average rate of return compounding, right? I mean, just think about investing $20,000 right now. Let's say your first car you buy at 22 out of college. It's 20 grand, right? Which is probably below average price of a car, actually, today. If you were to take 20 grand at age 22, put it in the market, say a stock and bond portfolio, say even 80-20 or whatever, index fund kind of thing, and you left it there for 50 years until you were 72, it grows into a pile of cash, right? Just compounding. You're talking, I could do the math while we're on the show here. And then
I did it while you were talking. It's about $1 million.
Right. And that's just your first car, right? And then 10 years later, let's say you sell it, you get a few thousand for it, you buy another $20,000 car. That's another 40 years you could have invested that. And we haven't talked about insurance, maintenance, gas. Now, I get it. Not everyone can go without a car. And we've had two cars until recently. A lot of what we do, we just do because that's what people do, right? You try to get a house if you can afford it. You get two cars if you got a family. That's just what people do. But after a while, you start to think, yeah, but do I have to do that? If you can go from two cars to one, the amount of money it will save is just extraordinary. And even if you can't, if you can just drive the car you've got as long as possible. The last car we got rid of, my wife had for 17 years, I think. So cars are a financial freedom killer. They are by far the biggest, worst expense you'll have. I mean, with a house, it at least holds its value, right? And hopefully appreciates. But cars, of course, don't. They just kill your budget. The less you can spend on a car, the better.
The one thing I would say about the houses is a lot of times people don't look at the price to rent ratio when they're buying a house. Yeah. So I had a great example of this recently. A couple in New York City was really convinced they wanted to buy a house. And then I went through the math and basically said, okay, the price to rent ratio is kind of like price to earnings ratio for a stock a little bit. And so this price to rent ratio in New York is closing in on 40. The price to rent ratio in Milwaukee is 12.
Right.
So you can buy a house in Milwaukee, and it's probably a great decision, no brainer. If you're going to stay there for even a couple years, it probably breaks even. Whereas in New York, you might not break even for 10 to 15 years. And most people change houses for various reasons, like getting married, getting divorced, moving jobs. I don't know. I would say that the housing expense it's interesting because, yeah, the house might hold its value, but it's still a huge expense that requires somebody to work for a really long time. What are your thoughts about housing?
Buying a house shouldn't be part of your financial freedom plan. It could be part of your life plan. You may want to own a home for reasons that don't go directly to financial freedom. But depending on where you live, yeah, buying a home may not be a great financial deal. I mean, we bought a home here in Northern Virginia. We just actually just moved, but our previous home we bought in 04, sold it 15 years later here just a couple of months ago, and we made nothing on it. We got basically the cost of the home plus what we put into it. Now, of course, we went through a huge housing crisis in the middle of all that was somewhat unprecedented, but there's no guarantee that the house is going to add to your financial freedom. I mean, I think for a lot of people, the one reason a house helps, apart from the leverage that you use to buy it, which, you know, can increase your return on investment if you want to put it on a spreadsheet, but in some ways, it's a forced savings mechanism, right? Because you're forced to use some of your income to pay the mortgage or you get kicked out. So it kind of forces people to put money towards a growing asset, even if you just look at the from the perspective of growing equity because the debt balance is going down. And if you add to that even a rate of inflation growth on a very large asset compared to most people's balance sheet, it can help long term. But you're absolutely right. In some markets, it's probably not a great financial decision.
For simple investing, you know, a lot of people like to talk about the three fund portfolio, and I certainly do, in terms of total stock market index fund, which is VTSEX, international index fund, which is VTIAX, and then VBTLX, the total bond market fund, versus tax-exempt bond fund if you're making a super high income. So I guess Rick Ferry likes to talk about that being the cake, and everybody gets so focused on the icing, but everybody forgets the cake. What do you think about simple investing? And do you have that kind of mentality about investing, or do you have a different one?
I have a very simple approach to investing. I mean, for a long time, I used a six fund portfolio. It wasn't much different than what you described, except that I had exposure to emerging markets, real estate, and small cap value, 10% in each through Vanguard index funds. So now, actually, it's funny, as I've gotten older and I have more money to invest, I've found that I take even simpler approaches. And what's interesting with financial advisors, because I've had some talk to me and I've met with them, and as you have more money to invest, for some reason, they think they want to complicate things. They want me to buy into the black swan portfolio that they've created or some complex real estate investment. And I just said, yeah, life is too short. Why do I want all the hassle of all this nonsense? So yeah, for us, 85% of our portfolio is in index funds. I do have 15% in individual stocks, but that's just because I'm human. There's just part of me that enjoys investing in individual stocks. It's a very focused portfolio. There's only four or five companies that I own.
That's interesting. My portfolio actually kind of looks similar to that six fund portfolio. I do like the idea of tilting a little bit, not being exactly like the market. But I think that the reality is I've underperformed the past 10 years. And that's because names like Google, Apple, Facebook have just dominated. The growth stocks of the world have done extremely well. And then what happens with 99% of people probably is if you have a 10-year period of underperforming, right, versus what everybody else is getting, you change your strategy. And so the thing is I'm comfortable having a tilt towards certain sectors for like decades, which it might work out, it might not. What's interesting is, and one thing that I've kind of realized a little bit, which is kind of ironic, is like I always used to think, okay, if I can get an extra, because of the math of compounding, if I can get an extra 2 or 3% per year, yeah, that could be game changing, you know, in terms of what we're able to do. And
that's huge.
And it is. But what I realized is that I could potentially get an extra 50% per year by focusing on growing the business that I accidentally made, kind of like what you did with Dough Roller, you know. That's kind of ironic because I'm thinking, okay, all my time needs to be spent focusing on my investment portfolio, figuring out how do I maximize my returns. But if you have a $10,000 amount, it matters only so much how high the return you get on that. And so a lot of times I think we forget that all the people listening to this, they're professionals, they have degrees, they could do entrepreneurial risk. And in fact, the entrepreneurial risk for the people listening to this podcast is significantly lower than it is for other people in the economy that are opening up a restaurant, which, you know, has a 50% failure rate or whatever. So I was wondering, in terms of investing, some of the examples in your own life, maybe you could draw on about what the return to entrepreneurship has been for you versus the return to trying to get your returns in your portfolio higher.
Well, they're really night and day. But in some ways, though, I do think it's an unfair comparison because I can try to structure a portfolio, tilting, like you said, maybe to value, emerging markets, in my case, a little bit in individual stocks. That doesn't take much time. I mean, it's insignificant. I just have to
be able passive.
Yeah, it's very passive. Whereas when I started my blog, I was up at 5 a.m. every day for 7 days a week for 2 years, working 5 a.m. to 7:30, then on work days, heading to D.C., working on the metro. I mean, it wasn't a financial investment. It cost me $10 to start my blog, but it was a huge investment in time. It was basically a decade I'll never get back. And I chose to invest a lot of my free time that way. And it paid off financially, and it paid off with very little financial risk. But, you know, at times it was very hard on my family. I don't regret doing it. I guess we could ask my wife. I don't think she regrets it, but it's night and day. I find it hard. Like, people want to compare owning real estate, which I own single family homes. I've since sold them, but I own five. I want to compare that to a stock market kind of investment. Well, they're night and day. You're using leverage for one, the other, hopefully you're not, to invest in the market. You're managing one or paying someone to manage it, and then you're managing them. Your liability risk, which of course you can protect against, but it is totally different. So I find it hard to take any meaningful things away from trying to compare, say, owning a business or investing in real estate versus, say, an index fund portfolio or even an individual stock portfolio.
That's a good point. I like to joke that if Bernie wins, then maybe I don't have a business anymore because all student loans are gone. And, you know, if Bernie wins, I'm pretty sure that my index funds will still be there and they will still exist.
Well, I'm going to predict if Bernie wins, your business will be just fine. I can't fathom the federal government's going to step in and say, we'll take care of $1.5 trillion plus, presumably, every student tuition payment for infinity. I think that's unlikely.
Well, you know, we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll be here hanging out until that happens. So,
have you taken a survey of your listeners as to who would support the idea? I mean, certainly if you have student loans, you'd love for someone to pay them off. I mean, it took me 20 years to pay mine off. I'd love to have someone come in and pay them off. I don't care if you're the government or the guy next door.
The real question is do you want your student loans to be forgiven in exchange for much higher taxes for the rest of your life? I think what's really interesting about student loans right now is if you look at all the forgiveness math and you kind of bake it in to figure out what the true effective interest rate is in some of these forgiveness plans, the effective interest rate is pretty close to like below inflation for a lot of these forgiveness plans. And so in reality, the government is getting the money back over time, but they're basically just charging a low or even negative interest rate. And they're doing it through the most convoluted process in the world versus just saying, here's your $100,000 for law school. It's 0%. And so then people would, of course, drag it out for eternity and try to pay it off over a longest period of time as possible. Instead of doing that, we have these income-driven repayment programs where we have these big tax bombs at the end. And that's another thing is all these tax bombs. I mean, the taxpayer is going to be paying for that. At the end of the day, people are not going to come up with $400,000 balance. People are going to pay $100,000 or $200,000 for the tax bomb when their loans are forgiven. Come on. People can barely come up with a $10,000 emergency fund in a lot of cases, even professionals live paycheck to paycheck. I mean, I tell everybody that listens to our show to be prepared for that tax bomb if you're going to potentially owe it, but just to know that it probably won't happen if I had to put a bet on it, just because Congress made this system in the absolute worst way possible. It's one of the worst designed programs, I think, that Congress has ever made. And it was good intentions, like try to increase access to education, increase access to degrees that people previously would not have been able to get the credit to do. So from that perspective, it's a success in the sense that a lot of people that are not white men are getting into fields that they've been underrepresented in the past. So like that's a real positive. Unfortunately, with the way that they've done it, it's been, I guess, politicians have not been really willing to have a really frank, upfront, direct conversation about this stuff. So you hide it in like all these different income-based repayment plans. You put a really high interest rate on it to try to incentivize people to maybe pay it back at some point. I don't know. It's just so interesting. We could go on all day about that. Any thoughts about the way the student loan system in America is designed, Rob?
Well, I know a lot of changes were made in 2010 that kind of tied into the Affordable Care Act. In some ways, it's not unlike the housing crisis, right? I mean, the housing crisis really was born out of both the Clinton and Bush administrations. It was well-intended, kind of like what you just described, trying to get folks who may not be able to traditionally afford a home to put them in a position where they could. But that ended up causing problems. You put more money and more leverage into the market, and it was just sort of a feeding frenzy that drove prices up, and people kept going and going and going until it obviously just collapsed and caused a lot of pain. And you know, there's probably a lot of blame that can go around from Main Street to Wall Street and Washington, D.C. But it seems to me we don't learn anything from it. That's the frustrating thing for me. We're doing the exact same thing with student loans. Here's the thing. Maybe it's my politics. I don't want to get too much into politics, but There's a lot of folks in Washington, D.C., of course, this is where I live and breathe. If a bank does something wrong, they drag the CEO in and demand answers, and well, they should. A Wall Street firm does something wrong or, you know, treats customers unfairly, they drag them in. Why aren't they dragging the presidents of these universities in who have increased tuition, even now at a greater rate since 2010 than before, and have them explain themselves? Because they're doing that on the back of taxpayers and students through student debt. I don't get that. And it's like somehow they get a free pass.
And the thing is I think that there's a thought that these not-for-profit institutions are somehow just noble or something, which I think is just a joke. It's kind of like the hospitals. People kind of view hospitals in America as these wonderful institutions when, unfortunately, I think that the way we've structured our healthcare and our education systems in America have made them corporate, profit-hungry companies that just happen to be registered under the 501c3 code of the Internal Revenue Service.
And here's a sort of related issue. I was, you know, of course, I went to law school, but I was an English major in undergrad, a humanities degree. But today, if I wanted to go get an English degree from some expensive private school, I could do it. And between government and private loans, I could get six figures in loans without much problem, really, particularly if I went and decided to get an advanced degree in English. There's no way in the world I'll be able to pay that off with that kind of degree. Not in any reasonable amount of time, putting aside some of the payment plans that exist now. And, you know, in any other market, a lender would get into a world of hurt if they were lending money to people that they knew probably couldn't pay it back. You know, there are laws and regulations that cover this. But somehow the student loan market is exempt from all of that. And I don't understand that.
Yeah.
And so you get these kids that, and they are kids. You know, when I was making that decision, you know, I was 18, right? I mean, what do I know? And then even law school at 22, I still knew nothing. So I'm making all these decisions and I graduated law school with $55,000 in school loans. This was 1992. So today that's what, 125, 150? I don't know. I was fortunate enough to have a job that I could pay it back, but it still took me a really long time. And I just don't understand why we're putting these young people into this kind of situation.
Well, at some point, the House of Cards is going to crash down. I'm hearing things right now, like some of the universities that have set up all these programs that are making all this money, and especially like chiropractic or pharmacy programs that just have a way bit, you know, overproduction of graduates problem right now. They're paying for students from undergrad to come spend the evening in their city. They're paying for their flights. They're paying for their hotels and their meals. And they're trying to recruit them basically at no cost to the person, and they're waiving application fees. So they're basically trying to make it so, so easy for somebody to sign away their life, just sign their name to federal loans that the financial aid office will easily get them into with no repercussions. And so at some point, that kind of dirty laundry is going to show up in the front page of the Wall Street Journal. I would guess, like, the way they dealt with the banks, there'll be a couple people that will get slaps on the wrists and nobody will go to jail. I'm grateful that I've been put in a place, though, to help people try to pick up the pieces, because that's something that the universities are really not doing very well.
Right.
And so I'm glad we're involved with that.
And at the end of the day, we each have to take responsibility for our choices. No one's forcing us to get a student loan. And however poorly the system has been designed, I guess we, at the end of the day, have to take accountability for our decisions and make the most of what can sometimes be a difficult road ahead.
Sure. And I've got a few more questions of things that you can control. So for retirement accounts, we try to tell people they need to save at least 15% of their income. Sometimes I find people are super confused with, they've heard of an IRA, but they don't know where to do it. So they just open up an IRA somewhere. Like a lot of times somebody's got an angry uncle that said that they need to do a Roth IRA because they're going to raise taxes so high, right? So a lot of people will randomly have a Roth IRA. They'll have a 403b or 401k or something like that. But then they'll get really confused because they'll look in their retirement account and they'll see something like Index Institutional Trust Plus, or they'll see all these really complicated names for the funds that the money could be put in. And you have these default investment options now, which have helped a little bit about that. But, you know, how should a new professional be thinking about retirement?
There's really two questions to answer. The first is, which account or accounts should you be saving in? Should it be a workplace retirement account, 401k, 403b, TSP, if you're a federal employee, for example? Should it be an IRA, which is not tied to your job? You open it up on your own, or even eventually a taxable account. But that's the first question. What kind of account? And of course, as you alluded to, should it be Roth or traditional? I sort of walk through all this in my book, but generally I think a 401k is the place to start usually. That's certainly true if they have matching. And I think for most people, the Roth is the best option for most people. The exceptions would be you're in a high income bracket, tax bracket, you live in a high income tax state where the deduction for a traditional 401k is going to be very valuable. But for most people, I think the Roth is the better option. But I like the 401k or other workplace retirement as a starting point, again, particularly if they have a match, but also because it's just easy. They take it right out of your paycheck. You don't see the money. You don't have to decide where to open it. It's going to be opened at whatever 401k administrator your employer has chosen. So to me, that's usually, again, these are all generalities. There's exceptions to everything, but generally the best approach, at least to take advantage of the match. There is an advantage to a Roth IRA, and that is you can always withdraw your contributions at any time, tax and penalty free. That's a blessing and a curse, right? It's a blessing because you get into a bind, you can access the money. It's a curse because sometimes people will access it when maybe they really shouldn't, but it is an advantage. And in terms of where to open it, my favorite's always been just Vanguard because you can get low cost index funds, but Fidelity has zero cost index funds. Schwab has low cost target date retirement funds, about 8 basis points, as I recall. I think Vanguard's around 14 or 15 basis points. Fidelities are expensive, so I would avoid their target date retirement funds. I don't know if I'm going too far down the rabbit hole for you, but this is how I think about it. Which account should you put it in? And then what should you invest in? Like you said, a 3-fund portfolio is a great place to start. Low-cost index funds.
The thing that I've kind of found is it really doesn't matter almost as long as you just save money. The reality is if it ends up in this account instead of that account or that investment instead of that investment, eventually it will work itself out if you have a high savings rate. I don't know if you disagree with that.
No, I don't disagree, but I would definitely focus on any matching contributions. That does matter if you have access to them. And in terms of the funds, I would just be looking at the expense ratios, which are very easy to find. The fund itself will tell you. You can also just take the ticker of the fund and put it in, say, Morningstar.com, and it'll tell you the expense ratio. Most index funds are really inexpensive, so it might not matter. But you don't want to assume that. And for an index fund, you really want to be, let's say 20 basis points or lower, meaning 0.2%. Where it gets more interesting is the target date retirement funds. Some of those get expensive. Fidelity's is, around 70 basis points. And I think that's just too expensive. These things, at the end of the day, a high savings rate, absolutely critical. And just starting, absolutely the most important. But when you start to look at 10, 20, 30, 40 years, these small things, the expense ratios that don't seem all that significant, for example, turn out to be huge when you multiply it over a lifetime of saving and investing.
One more question for you on content. So what happens when somebody runs a 21-day experiment about their finances, and what does that even mean?
This is sort of goes to the second way. You know, we talked about the money audit, which is your monthly bills, but what about your sort of lifestyle spending? And people love to hate the latte factor as an example, right? Where, you know, if you give up your latte and save the $5, you know, multiplied by X number of years, you have a bunch of money. And it is a challenge. How much should you enjoy today versus saving for tomorrow, right? There's no one answer to that. We each have to answer that for ourselves. But what I found is what I thought I needed to spend today to enjoy it turned out not necessarily to be true. And I'll just use the latte as an example. I used to get a mocha every single day, 7 days a week. And I stopped more for health reasons. But when I stopped, I was miserable. I mean, for like a week, that's all I could think about. But after about 3 weeks, like I didn't even give it a second thought. And it's now been years. I still go to a coffee shop every now and again, not every day. It was interesting to me. It's like, you know, I was kind of addicted to these mochas. But when I just said no for 3 weeks, I didn't miss them. And in fact, was happier without them. And so that's kind of where the 21-day experiment was born in my own life. And that is come up with things that you might think can save you some money that you're not sure you want to do. Could be your daily latte, could be whether you park your car for 3 weeks and don't use it. Turn off your TV for 3 weeks. Again, we all have to make the decisions on our own as to what specifically we're going to test. But go without it for 21 days. You may find that it may be painful the first week, maybe even a little painful the second, but after 3 weeks, you may not miss it at all. And if you do, that's fine. You've tried an experiment. It didn't work out. And you go back to what you were doing and you experiment in some other area of your life.
That's awesome. Rob, where can people find you? And what takeaway message should we have for our listeners?
Well, they can find me at retirebeforemomanddad.com. I think the takeaway message is, and this is particularly true for those struggling with a lot of school loans. I won't pretend that it's always easy. It's not. And I've been there. But I think we have a lot more control over our finances than sometimes, and our financial future than we sometimes think, or that others will sometimes lead us to believe. Doesn't mean the path is easy, but I think if we start to realize how these small daily decisions affect our finances over the long term, we'll see just how much control we have. That in turn can help us start making smarter decisions today that will put us in a better place tomorrow.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Rob.
Thanks, Travis. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to today's show. If you know that you need a custom student loan plan, you can schedule one today at studentloanplanner.com/book. You can find the show notes for today's episode at studentloanplanner.com/the number of the episode. And finally, if you like the podcast, leave us a review or share it with someone who owes more than you. Have a great week.